up next, our old friend Bathrop Spears Broadsides, 3.5 hours of it on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. Today, July 13th, 2003. Stay with us.
For only one reason, that president raises the question, who owns a man? The homeless are a problem. For only one reason, our president raises the question, who owns a man? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? And who owns the land? So that's in 99 dead in the end. Who owns the land? So that's 6 million Jews. Who owns the land? This is our connection. Who owns the land? To all imperialism. Who owns the land? Well, someone please tell me. Who owns the land? I am just a white man. Who owns the land? I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get in here? This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to sleep. This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to be. Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be that there's a connection? Who owns the land? To my daily eviction. Who owns the land? And the extermination. Who owns the land? Of the Native American. Who owns the land? Won't someone please tell me? Who owns the land? I am just a white man. Who owns the land? I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get here? The question, who was the
man? Exercise, genocide, where is home? Exercise, genocide, where is home? Exercise, genocide, where is home? Exercise, genocide, where is
home? And welcome to another edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm, of course, the, a little bit out of breath, Robert Norris. Actually, I'm doing okay. Skidmark Bob is listening to this broadcast. Skidmark, come on down to the studio. I need those tapes. using the radio as a telephone, you know how it is. Anyway, we got lots of stuff coming up today in the next 3.5 hours. This show specializes in civil rights on the streets. I've got some special call-ins from some interesting places. One from San Francisco, California. A contact with San Francisco Liberation Radio, which is under threat of FCC seizure again. They're not clear whether they're going to seize, go to court, jump up and down in a tantrum state or what, but they've already been to the San Francisco Liberation Studio, and we're going to be having on the air with us by phone one of the Free Radio, well, actually Liberation, San Francisco Liberation Radio is what it's called, a woman named Caroline, who is working very closely, or actually is either a broadcaster or a techie up there at San Francisco Liberation Radio. She's going to be reaching us probably around 10 or shortly thereafter. And then this morning, a little bit later, we have a special treat. Those of you may remember Katzenjammer Keith McHenry, a Food Not Bombs activist extraordinaire in San Francisco, who has almost single-handedly revitalized Food Not Bombs, starting in San Francisco, actually starting way back in Cambridge in the late 70s, early 80s. And then when he came to San Francisco and began feeding regularly and the massive police crackdown followed, his example, an example of many Food Not Bombers like him, led to spreading of Food Not Bombs throughout the country, groups that dramatize the waste in American society, the misplaced priorities in terms of military and police expenditures over human and social service expenditures, and also how the ordinary, what's thrown away from grocery stores, what's ignored or discarded, can actually be turned into very tasty and healthful food. Food Not Bombs in Santa Cruz serves vegan food three times a week. I believe it's 4 o'clock on Mondays down at Cooper and Pacific, around the same time, maybe a little later, at the Farmer's Market on Wednesday. And I think on Saturdays they also serve, I'm not too clear, I think it's at the San Lorenzo Park, at least it used to be, and it was around, what, 2 or 2:30, something like that. To get the times right, you can give a call to Food Not Bombs locally at 425-3345, 425-3345. And it's a good group. I worked with them for many years. I'm still sort of sympathetic. Well, I'm definitely sympathetic, but I'm still hoping, I get all concerned when I hear the police start busting them, and I want to go up and start serving in solidarity. I've been arrested with them in the past, been jailed. We have successfully been able to beat back the soup snatchers, as we call them here in Santa Cruz, the people under Marty Wormhout when she was mayor, who wanted to close down the feeding operations. And similar problems under, I guess, Mayor Yokoyama and Don Lane, although, it was through standing up against this stuff that Food Not Bombs has been able to assure that the right to serve free food, which is now being challenged in different cities like Santa Monica, eager to drive away homeless people and those who help them, have barred, I guess, feedings of more than 100 or something in the park, requiring permits and so forth. And the attorneys for different civil liberties groups and social service groups are fighting that down there, and hopefully they'll win. I'll hope to get a report from them one of these days and put it on the air. You can often follow that story in Street Spirit, the homeless newspaper published out of the American Friends Service up in San Francisco, and you can get that paper on the streets here in Santa Cruz from vendors for a buck. Good investment. And there's also a Street Sheet, which covers some of that stuff, too. That's another San Francisco homeless paper, not so easily findable down here, but very prevalent and very easy to find on the streets of San Francisco from homeless folks who are selling it to make money. So, two guests. The first, San Francisco Liberation Radio, what's happening up there. And then the second, Keith McHenry from Tucson, Arizona, who is under, apparently, indictment again in Arizona. He was notorious in San Francisco for his persistent, high-profile criticism of repressive leadership in the mayor's office and the police department. He attacked the hypocrisy and repressiveness of four administrations, starting with Feinstein back in the 80s, going to Agnos, the phony liberal, at the end of the 80s. Then we had the police chief, Frank Jordan, under his Matrix program. And then the even more hypocritical whitewash Willie Brown, who has been the boss of San Francisco since 1996, or actually 95, late 95. McHenry's been in there pitching. They've beaten him up. I think he's been beaten more than a dozen times. He's been charged more than 100 times. He was charged with felony possession of a milk crate, a charge that was picked up by Officer Butchie Lauren Baker here in Santa Cruz, Sticky Fingers Butchie, as we call him, the sergeant who's been on the mall kind of directing the harassment of poor homeless young people down there and going after political activists. He did the same thing that Jason Pascal went after him for a milk crate. It wasn't a felony. He was going after him for a misdemeanor. Baker always pulls out his code book to find obscure statutes, and if he doesn't, he makes them up, as, for example, when he went after us for no sound permit on the mall when we were doing a video showing of a police harassment film recently. Anyway, Keith McHenry coming on 10:30 today. Tune in for that. He's going to be, I think, a lively guest. He's always informative, usually humorous, well, almost always humorous, and it'll be good to hear him. I haven't heard from him in a long time. In case you want to call the station, the phone number here is 427-3772, 831-427-3772. Voicemail, in case you want to leave a message off air for the studio, PSA, you've got a contribution, you got a question about operations. It's 427-4523, 427-4523. In case you want to catch us on the web, www.freakradio.org. Oh, somebody's calling already. Let's see who's on the line here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, this is David.
Hey, David, what's up?
Oh, not much. How you doing?
I'm good. Good. What's happening?
Well, I can talk about any issue, right? Or what?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I just, you know, interesting, the whole Bush thing going on now. It's not turning out. What do you think about it? It's not turning out as it hoped it would be. The Iraq war is costing now, what do we know, at least $4 billion a month. I read the giant corporations, Bechtel, et cetera, becoming unnerved a little bit at this point that they're not able to fully invest as they would like. And, you know, although the war was immoral and nothing's happened, they're beginning to chip away at Chip Bush's armor with the George Tenet's CIA allegations. What do you think about it all? What kind of possibilities do you see?
Well, actually, I kind of loaded up on a bunch of stories about Iraq before I came down to the studio this morning. Interesting stuff. Even on mainstream sources like AP and Reuters, who are normally cheerleaders, particularly AP, for the Bush war policies, you've got, of course, Bush in a tangle. And the real tangle he's in, of course, is he's in Iraq, and the Iraqis are shooting back. You know, and the Iraqis are engaging in guerrilla war and uprisings. And to me, it looks like a no-win situation. I mean, I guess the military and the administration thinks that somehow through this new Iraqi council, which is an advisory group which they put together, which looks like sort of a, you know, one of their, we have, what, I don't know, actually, I can read a little bit about it. There's you got the majority of Shiites for the first time in a supposedly a position of power, but of course this is an advisory council with no ultimate powers. I guess they're touting the fact that they have the power to appoint a minister or ministers, and all they need to do is get the okay of the military Führer there, what's his name, Bremer, something like that.
Right.
You know, and so they have to go through that. In Washington, you've got Bush, who is really floundering around to deal with this the falsification of supposedly Iraq going to Niger, or was it Nigeria? I guess it was Niger, to seek uranium, a discredited falsification from apparently British intelligence last fall. The problem he's having is he's trying to say the matter is all over, the CIA chief Tenet has taken responsibility for all this. But of course, Tenet, the record is pretty clear. I mean, Tenet does what he's told to do, I assume. He is an appointee after all. But it's pretty clear that Tenet told, and other officials told Cheney, and it was quite, you know, evident in the fall that this was a report that they did not place credence in. And yet in January, even though, you know, Bush knew about this, he's saying, oh, well, he should have come in and specifically told me not to include it in my speech. It wasn't vetted, as he says. Right. Well, I think it's going to be hard to fly before the American people, though the American people continue to give this what do we call them, doltish militarists, this kind of yahoo from, I don't know, I don't want to, I got nothing against people who are rednecks, frankly, I really don't, as human beings. For example, I mean, down on the mall when we were fighting to
get out the message of boycotting these bigoted stores that are criminalizing poor people on the streets, like Pacific Trading Company. There was a South Carolinian who came up there a week ago when Steve Argue and Matt Hartog were arrested, and he was talking about the Constitution, and he was, you know, I served in the military. I come through to, you know, he's... His red, his neck is as red as they come, man. And the guy was—he was great. You know, you got Bush in there, and he's—I'm afraid he's got a mentality without the hard work.
Yeah. One question. I listened to Flashpoints the other day. I don't know if you guys get Flashpoints. Yeah. You guys get that here?
Yeah. Yeah. Flashpoints actually is broadcast on free radio.
What time is it?
That's a good question. I think it's in the mornings, 8 or 9 o'clock, and it might, but again, the thing for you to do is call the voicemail for anybody who's interested and wants that kind of schedule information, 427-4523. Go ahead.
They had Ramsey Clark on, and he already put his articles of impeachment on the table, and there was a discussion with Dennis Bernstein about how far this will go, not only the impeachment process, but minimally more of a scandal on Bush. And, I mean, from what I was hearing in the radio, that, you know, for whatever reasons, the ruling class or the Democrats don't really want to take it too far at this point. In fact, they may never, although it might hurt Bush in the election, but they won't take it as far as Clinton and Monica or Watergate. What do you think?
Well, I mean, Clinton was bombing the Iraqis for, you know, a decade, and he's engaged in similar kinds of activities, you know.
No, but I mean Monica Gate, and that's
Monica Gate.
How far will this go? And they're saying, chance it won't go that far, but it might be a campaign problem.
I haven't really studied that issue. I've always thought the Monica thing was, you know, kind of irrelevant, although it, you know, went to Clinton's credibility, no question about it. But, you know, the issue, the real issues of war and peace and people dying and people and, you know, children not having the medical care they need, and so hundreds of thousands of them dying over in Iraq, which has happened over the last decade, is a Clinton-Bush production.
Right.
It's a Bush-Clinton-Bush production, actually, you know, all the way from way back to the first Bush. And I guess... it looks like the chickens are going to come home to roost. I have to not just hope that. I mean, it has to look that way, given what's going on. I mean, you also have accounts. AP has accounts of people coming out from the CIA and the administration talking about the Al-Qaeda hoax. That there's no credible links of any significant kind between Iraq and the regime there, with the Saddam Hussein regime and the Al-Qaeda. That's in today's AP. I'll read a little bit of that in a bit, too.
I suspect it's all coming out. We all knew this, obviously, just because they're just freaked. There's no way out of this war. It's very expensive. $4 billion a month. Afghanistan, they're spending $800 million a month. It's just outrageous.
Yeah, I mean, what we have here in Santa Cruz, of course, is a city council refusing to take a position demanding that the U.S. get out of Iraq. I mean, Emily Riley has been pussyfooting around this matter for months. She's refused to put it on the agenda again. The Kennedy and Porter resolutions that were supposed to come out in April after the scandalously under-attended town hall meeting, because not advertised by Riley and the council and delayed too long, hasn't made it on the agenda. And we have a council instead pushing for Armed Forces Day, commend our armed forces. That was two weeks ago, I guess. They had that at city council. Joe Williams brought that up. What the hell is the city council doing praising the military in this situation and not calling on the administration to save the people that are over there, both the Iraqis and the Americans, from this political bullshit that really is what's going down in Iraq? This is an election ploy or a combination of things. I mean, I can't, you know, it's hard to motivate, you figure out the real motivations. Is it, you know, fundamentalist madness on the part of Bush? Is he just pandering to a right-wing constituency? Is he under pressure from the Israeli government right-wingers to do this? Is this just a bunch of neocon nuts? I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, different pressures and reasons. I don't know.
One more thing I want to say is that, you know, 4 months ago, all of us were worried about the next war, and, you know, Bush may strike out in a frenzy against Iran and North Korea, but I really think that this is really economically and resource-wise, military-wise, has curtailed Bush's possibility of attacking Iran short of all-out air assault. I think it's less likely now, at least now, they'll attack Iran and North Korea, and I wanted to say I love you to my daughter, shall we?
All right.
Bye.
Hey, thank you, David. And, hey, phone lines are open, 427-3772. Yeah, a couple of things while we're at it with respect to the war. And it's a continuing war. I mean, it's an occupation, and you say, we've won the war. Yeah, right. I suppose, except that, you know, Tom Paxton used to say, look at all the ground we're gaining. Just don't take one step outside of town, talking about Vietnam. And, of course, you have reports of what? several dozen attacks in the last 2 days, not necessarily fatal attacks, not even attacks that cause casualties, but attacks on American troops. Now, let me get that figure exactly right. I don't want to be exaggerating it. I'm going to just run through a few of these stories. CIA wanted to cut claim, according to Reuters. CIA intervened to stop the White House from making a reference to Iraq seeking uranium from Niger in a presidential speech last October. So the White House was advised 3 months before the January speech, which Bush was, you know, doing the, it's all over, the CIA boss has taken responsibility for not going in there and cutting the speech before I gave it. He cut the speech 3 months before. He advised the White House before to remove this bogus information about Niger, about Iraq seeking uranium in Niger. 3 months before, in a less specific reference, the same intelligence was used in President George W. Bush's January State of the Union address then in January. CIA Director George Tenet argued to White House officials it should not be used because it came from only a single source, the newspaper reported, citing one senior official. The Washington Post cited another senior official with knowledge of the intelligence as saying the CIA had doubts about the accuracy of the documents underlying the allegations, which turned out to be forged. The report said it was unclear why Tenet personally intervened to prevent the intelligence about Niger from appearing in the earlier presidential speech, but did not do so again for the State of the Union message address in January. Speaking in Abuja on Saturday, Bush said he had confidence in Tenet. Yeah, he wants to say it's all okay, even though Tenet screwed up here. He's going to forgive him, try to look like the charitable guy. But in fact, it looks like more leaks are coming out of the CIA, indicating that they don't like to be blamed for political decisions made by the White House when their reports were, in essence, however much we may not particularly like the CIA, they don't want to get the flack for making stupid decisions to invade a country and occupy it when you have no plan after that, other than sending in a discredited Shabali, who was the, or is it Shalabi, I'm not sure which. I'm going to look back at that report. The New York Times had an editorial called The Uranium Fiction yesterday. We're glad that someone in Washington has finally taken responsibility for letting President Bush make a false accusation about Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program in the State of the Union address last January, but the matter will not end there. George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, stepped up to the issue yesterday when he said the CIA had approved Mr. Bush's speech and failed to advise him to drop the mistaken charge that Iraq had recently tried to import significant quantities of uranium from an African nation, later identified as Niger. Now the American people need to know how the accusation got into the speech in the first place, and whether it was put there with an intent to deceive the nation. My aside, they also need to know about the other five or six things, significant things, such as the bullshit around the Al-Qaeda, the nonsense about the weapons of mass destruction, and a whole series of questionable, if not false, claims that are the basis for this pump-up-my-popularity war in Iraq by Führer Bush. The White House has got a lot of explaining to do, continues the New York Times. So far, the administration's handling of this important and politically explosive issue has mostly involved a great deal of finger-pointing instead of an exacting reconstruction of events and an acceptance of blame by all those responsible. Mr. Bush himself engaged in the free-for-all yesterday while traveling in Africa when he said his speech had been cleared by the intelligence services. That led within a few hours to Mr. Tenet's mea culpa. It is clear, however, that much more went into this affair than the failure of the CIA to pounce on the offending 16 words of Mr. Bush's speech. A good deal of information already points to a willful effort by the war camp and the administration to pump up an accusation that seemed shaky from the outset, and that was pretty well discredited long before Mr. Bush stepped into the well of the House of Representatives last January. Doubts about the accusation were raised in March 2002 by Joseph Wilson, a former American diplomat, after he was dispatched to Niger by the CIA to look into the issue. Wilson has said he is confident that his concerns were circulated not only within the agency, but also at the State Department and the office of Vice President Dick Cheney. Tenet, CIA director, in a statement yesterday confirmed that Wilson's findings had been given wide distribution, although he reported that Mr. Bush, Mr. Cheney, and other high officials had not been directly informed about them by the CIA. The uranium charge should never have found its way into Mr. Bush's speech. Determining how it got there is essential to understanding whether the administration engaged in a deliberate effort to mislead the nation about the Iraqi threat. Looks like even when the New York Times, which has not been a big critic of the war, really, starts to express its concerns, it's time for the Führer to get nervous. And I'm frankly pleased that that's happening. We have, however, coming up shortly, a phone call about San Francisco Liberation Radio, so I'm going to read you a press release I got from Richard Edmondson, who hosted San Francisco Liberation Radio, which is one of our sister micro-power radio stations in San Francisco. And here is a press release that was sent out on July 10th to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Oppose any efforts by the Federal Communications Commission to close our radio stations. This was the message given by six micro-radio supporters who took turns addressing the San Francisco Board of Supervisors at the board's regular meeting on July 8th. The city of San Francisco is honored throughout the world as the home of one of the longest-running micro-radio stations in America, and for that we should be proud, said Carolyn Hatch, and that's the woman who's going to be calling in shortly, of San Francisco Liberation Radio at 93.7 FM. Broadcasting in the city's Castro District, the station was visited by agents of the FCC on Wednesday, July 2nd. The agents issued a notice of illegal broadcasting and requested permission to come on the premises and inspect the transmitting equipment. Entrance to the station was denied by the DJs on duty at the time. The visit has led some to speculate that the FCC may return with armed federal marshals and carry out a raid on the station. I am here to urge the members of the board to support and develop and pass a resolution in support of San Francisco Liberation Radio, said Stephen Schubert. Broadcasting at 100 watts, San Francisco Liberation Radio has been on the air for 10 years, offering a variety of programming, including extensive commentary opposing the recent war in Iraq. We've had such visits from the FCC in the past, but the last one was over 4 years ago, San Francisco Liberation Radio co-founder Richard Edmondson told the board. Also present at the meeting was Mike of Bayview Hunters Point Radio, broadcasting at 103.3 FM. Our station is a forum for young people who want to express themselves and how to turn the community around, he said. I also came to support 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio. We're in this together. Thank you. Charlotte Hatch pointed out that the San Francisco Liberation Radio has a long history focusing on the needs of homeless people, while local musician Larry Shaw said that in addition to providing quality programming, the station also serves as a statement that we do not approve of what is going on with the public airwaves being owned by just a few corporations. The July 2nd visit to San Francisco Liberation Radio came 1 month to the day after the FCC relaxed caps on the number of TV stations one corporation can own and largely abolished a decades-old ban on cross-ownership of newspapers and TV stations in the same market. San Francisco Liberation Radio has applied to the FCC for a license on two occasions and been denied both times. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Good morning.
Hi.
This is Caroline Hatch with San Francisco Liberation Radio.
Oh, excellent. Hi, Caroline. You're on the air.
Terrific.
And I just read here the statement by, I guess, San Francisco Liberation Radio, or by Richard Edmondson, about the address to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors on July, I guess, 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And I was about to read the resolution. Should I do that before you begin, or would you like to speak first?
Well, since I'm already here, we could speak first if you prefer to read it now.
No, that's fine. Why don't I read it after we've spoken? Go ahead.
Okay. What would you like to know? I'm not exactly sure where we are in.
Well, maybe
show.
You can give us a little of your involvement with the radio station. What are you up to down there? What kind of role do you perform?
I've been a DJ for 2 years, and I also try to help out as much as possible with publicity and with little things that are going on around the station. You know, I take on some responsibilities.
And I guess San Francisco Liberation Radio went off the air for a while in the late 80s?
Yeah, in response to Stephen Denifer being granted the FCC being granted the injunction against Stephen Denifer.
In the Berkeley, Free Radio Berkeley.
Yeah, Free Radio Berkeley, sorry.
But then you came back on the air. Why this change of heart or bucking up of courage or new move?
It was all planned to be just a brief time off the air in solidarity, but the plan was to go back on the air after that.
And how many people are actually involved with San Francisco Liberation Radio as DJs?
We have a phone list of about 60 people.
Wow. And are you a 24-hour station, or are you
No, we're on from 9 in the morning until about 11 or 12 at night.
Huh. Well, we're 24 hours. Nee. although I can't vouch for the quality of all the 24 hours, just my time, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So were you in any way, what was your reaction when you heard that bureaucrats have been a-knocking at the door of the station?
Well, frankly, it was a little bit startling, of course, but frankly, I was a little bit surprised they didn't come for so long, actually, because we've been at the present location. We moved 1 year ago, and we've been at the present location for a year now, and we haven't received any word from them whatsoever.
Hmm.
And we've seen, like, suspicious cars throughout that year, you know, parked strangely outside. But for the most, I mean, there hasn't been any formal contact from the FCC, and that was kind of surprising. But then the feeling was around the station was kind of like, oh yes, so it's begun, you know. The battle of the letters has begun, I suppose.
So what was the prior contact the FCC had with the station? What prior to this recent, I guess this recent thing was, what, a week or two ago? Or?
Mm-hmm, it was July 2nd.
Uh-huh.
And before the station had moved, the FCC had come, or we'd had, I think, upwards of about 10 to 15 interactions with the FCC. I don't remember the nature of every single one of those, but we applied for a license twice, one in 19... We went off the air in the 90s because we weren't around in the 80s. So we applied right after Free Radio Berkeley was put off the air, because the judge granted the injunction to the FCC only on the grounds that Stephen Denifer did not try to change the rules. And because his argument was, well, there aren't any permits available, why should I have tried to apply for one? And her response was, well, you should have just tried to change the rules, is basically what. So we then went ahead and applied for a non-existent license, one that was not available to any station under 100 watts, and asked for about a kabillion waivers of all the regulations that we couldn't live up to. And then we applied again in 2000 when the low-power FM legislation went through, and it became at least theoretically possible for a low-power FM station to get a license.
And what was the result of that application?
The second one, we haven't heard anything. And that was actually the last contact that we had with the FCC, was that application filing.
That's kind of slow, 2 or 3 years for application time.
Tell me about it.
Have they granted any licenses to any micropower stations in San Francisco?
Oh, no, not in San Francisco. The way that the legislation was written, it's there's too wide, like, too many spaces have to exist on the dial in order for a micro radio station to exist. Like, there has to be two blank spots on either side of you, which as a micro station is, I think, a bit excessive and does not reflect the reality of what the radio station would interfere with. Like, we exist, and actually Free Radio Santa Cruz also exists with one station, with one blank station on either side, and then we're between KPFA and the Wave, and there's one dial space between us on either side.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of the regulations being so strict about how much space on a dial has to exist, there's no blank spots in pretty much any urban area in the country. There's no blank spots large enough to have a micro radio station.
Have any urban areas gotten new micro radio stations under the 2000 so-called, you know, opening for micro power stations?
I don't think so. I'm not sure, but I don't think so.
I'll have to ask our resident expert, the V-Man, see what he knows about that.
He would probably know more.
He might well have all the details. V-Man, call in when you can. We're talking with Carolyn, is it Hatch?
Yeah.
And Carolyn, are the folks at the station nervous? I mean, have you increased security here in Santa Cruz? We go on kind of red alert when we start hearing other stations are under attack. Like we have cameras in the studio, and we get someone on video camera on alert to come on down, and we set up we get ready to anticipate the possibility that the FCC may break down our door.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or otherwise do something to seize our equipment and get into the studio. What kind of preparations have you made? And speak loudly so the police can hear you.
Well, as you say, I mean, we have similar measures. We have, a number of DJs at the station have cell phones and don't have jobs right now. So we've sort of devised this plan that if they do come, then we're going to get as many people there as possible. We have a couple pro bono lawyers that similarly said that they would come to the station if anything happened. Because, the situation at the station is it's going to take them a while to get all the equipment out. So we figure we have, like, anywhere between like 10 and 20 minutes to get people there just to show support and to also to be witnesses to what they do, you know.
What about elsewhere in the country? Have you heard of, I guess I've heard of one station being closed down because they were foolish enough to let the FCC in.
Yeah, Brattleboro, Vermont.
Yeah.
I hear you guys are having some pressure. Actually, Berkeley Liberation Radio hasn't been getting any more flack. I think they applied for a license, and that was a big deal.
Huh.
And but they're suffering a similar problem, actually, that you guys are too. K-Love, a Christian rock station from Sacramento or something. I'm not exactly sure. Bot or Peter Station in the Bay Area at their frequency, at 104.1. Which seems strange to me that a giant, corporate radio station can buy, what I was talking about before, the second adjacent rule, or the rule that there has to be so many spaces on either side mm-hmm. of the station. A giant station can buy a repeater station in an area where the dial is very densely packed, but a micro radio station can't broadcast on that same frequency.
Right, it's interesting. I mean, as you pointed out here, we have been essentially half our area blasted away by a repeater with a directionally aimed Christian rock message from Salinas, I guess it is, destroying, people coming up to me and saying, we can't hear that, you can't hear you anymore. Well, you've got to move to another band, and I guess people are talking about, or we're talking about doing that, and I actually haven't heard the latest update. Maybe I will shortly if I ever get to a meeting of the Free Radio Collective. What about the media in San Francisco? How are they responding? I read a short story about this in the Chronicle, which seemed actually to be actually have some information in it. It was admittedly buried in Section B.
Right. That article is pretty good. We've gotten the independent media, like the Independent Media Center, and several different pirate radio stations from actually not the Bay Area, but throughout the country have called, and we were on the KPFA evening news, and we were on the KQED morning edition, and I think that pretty much, and I think there's going to be a Guardian, San Francisco Bay Guardian article written about us. Mm-hmm. There's some guy called and interviewed a few people.
What about your sister station in, I guess it's Hunters Point area? What Bayview Hunters Point Radio at 103.3, are they? Mm-hmm. Are you guys collaborating? Are they worried about this too?
They are worried, but strangely enough, the Chronicle reporter who interviewed me actually told me that he'd interviewed the FCC, and the spokesperson for the FCC had said that they were not investigating Bayview Hunters Point. They were only investigating San Francisco Liberation Radio. Hmm. So I told him that. I mean, whatever that whatever that means.
Huh? Who was the reporter on that story? You remember?
Joe Garofoli was his name.
Huh? And did he actually got a who did he? You know what FCC official he spoke with?
Yeah, I don't have the article on me right now, but it was a spokesperson for the FCC. It wasn't the person who came to our door, but it was somebody different.
Mm-hmm. Have you been getting much financial support, like people saying, hey, we'll back you up if they take your equipment, we'll buy some more equipment for you?
No.
Well, let's get in there and get some financial support, everybody out there. Send your pennies.
Getting all this press is no easy business.
I hear you. Well, listen, how can people, in fact, give you financial support or other kinds of moral support? What can we do down here?
I think from that distance, financial support might be the best thing. If you felt like calling the Chronicle or writing a letter to the editor of the Chronicle and asking them to write a more in-depth story that includes more issues of micro radio, then that would be great. But also, we have you can donate to our station online through PayPal at liberationradio.net. And we have a P.O. box, which is 14455 San Francisco 94114, where donations can be sent to Friends of San Francisco Liberation Radio.
Hmm. Okay. Sounds good. So again, it's liberationradio.net,
mm-hmm.
P.O. box 1455.
14455.
That's 14,455.
Yeah.
14455. There we go. At
95114? Mm-hmm. 94114.
94. There we go, Mr. Dyslexic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's post office box 14455, zip code 94114. And for those who don't get this number, I will make it available to you. I actually wrote it down, so I should be able to read it again if I can read in writing, which sometimes I can't. At 423-HUFF, if you want to give a call, anyone out there, to 423-4833, leave a message. I'll try to repeat that information to you at a later time when you actually have a pencil and paper in hand. Well, Carolyn, I appreciate the call. Anything you want to pass on before we, I'm going to kind of roll into reading the supervisor's
resolution.
When is that coming up for a vote? Let me ask you that.
I'm not sure. Matt Gonzalez said, the president of the board, said that he was going to try to sponsor for this week, but it may end up being the week after because they have really heavy issues this coming week.
The budget.
The budget and Proposition N, which is our care, not cash bill. I'm not sure if you...
That's a cash-in on the carelessness or cash-in on callousness or whatever it is.
Exactly. So far away, and you know everything about San Francisco politics. That's great.
Well, hardly.
That's important.
Gosh. Well, we could go on for a bit, but we got Keith McHenry coming on the air at 10:30. He's being harassed apparently in Tucson, Arizona. If you want anybody up there wants to tune in, you might let people know that we are at www.freakradio.org, and you can hear us streaming up there, maybe, or even listening as we speak.
I know, but terrific. I will let people know.
Okay.
Very interesting to hear Keith McHenry. He's great.
If you do get anything like a bus, please call us immediately, and I don't know what good it'll do, but we'll put out the word, and maybe you can get a couple of checks. We've been looking for checks for a while. I don't think it's been hard for us to scrounge up money, but sometimes in times of crisis, people do rally. Would you say that San Francisco Liberation Radio does more news about the Führer's Iraqi adventures than other stations? I'm talking about Bush's war.
Yeah, I would say that we do more from that point of view than other stations do, certainly. We're fairly radical in our stance on things like war and peace and, domestic crises like the homeless situation. And
you have actually homeless broadcasters who come in and... camp in your studio under the board and that sort of thing.
We have a few people in transition sort of that are sometimes homeless and sometimes not.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got a variety of. How are your relations with Pacifica? I've always been kind of damning Pacifica with faint praise because I've always felt they kind of abandoned the community scene even after they won back their Democracy Now and that sort of thing.
I mean, they covered us on their nightly news. That was pretty shocking to me. But it seems to be a relationship of sort of, I don't know, they haven't said anything other than put us on the news. They haven't complained, apparently. I mean,
they haven't sent a letter supporting your right to be on the air, or they haven't stood up for that, editorialized for that.
That might be something we should go after, but no, up until now. No contact, really. There are a few people at the station that work for different, or, volunteer for KPFA and do different things.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What about KGO? I'm sure they're behind you 100%.
They're our best friends.
Yes, and Gavin Newsom is...
No, just kidding.
Is Gavin going to be a guest on your next broadcast supporting
We're
you?
Welcoming him.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if he wants to come on the radio, yeah. We've had a couple other mayoral candidates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he could get him there, too.
Oh, boy.
We'd go so far as to even, so far for, the importance of information dissemination that we'd even let Gavin Newsom on there.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've had Mike Rodkin on, our local socialist abroad, fascist at home character. In terms of how he treats the poor and homeless people and local ordinances here. Well, listen, I appreciate you being on the air, and I appreciate your bearing with me for 20 minutes. Give you the last word if you want it.
Keep us going. Still there. Everybody else should get little radio stations and go on the air as well.
Yeah, we keep saying that, but I guess Bayview did, but I haven't heard of many other people who have. I guess maybe I haven't.
But I think there's a lot of people that maybe do it and don't get connected with the micro radio movement. Sometimes you're driving, sometimes you can be driving along in a car, and so tuning to the dial and find crazy stations that don't give any station ID, but just play music for, and I've been in micro radio. I've been interested in micro radio for years, and
You get a few people out there.
Yeah, it's exciting. So, but it's not very expensive. It's very easy.
How much does it cost to put on a micro radio station?
It depends on what size you want and how big you want to go, but you could get it done for, you know, I mean, if you had a computer and you wanted to run it off the computer, you could get it done for, you know, probably $400.
Huh. So, and finally, how many watts does San Francisco Liberation Radio have?
100 watts of power.
Oh, you're just at the upper reaches there, huh?
Mm-hmm.
If you had 101 watts, would that complicate your situation? Or?
I'm not exactly sure about that. I think that's sort of a gray area of bureaucratic paperwork. I think that we would be out of the low-power FM, but...
But you're criminals anyway. You're outlaws.
Exactly.
You're pirates. Maybe.
It might actually help our situation.
Oh, maybe get some kind of corporate funding.
We'd rather shoot ourselves in the head, thank you.
Indeed. Carolyn Hatch of San Francisco Liberation Radio, thank you very much for being with us, and keep us advised. What's the phone number call-in for San Francisco Liberation Radio? People want to reach you.
Into the studio is 415-648-9222.
415-648-9222.
My best to V-Man.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
And again, the number to reach San Francisco Liberation Radio on air is 415-648-9222. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, however, and our number is 427-3772 if you want to tune in or call in to us. Looks like somebody does. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I heard my name.
Yes, Mr. V-Man.
You have a question?
Well, yes, two things. First of all, we have... What was the question? I'll have to tell you about it later, Amy. But the second one is, we're looking for Skidmark Bob because I've got tapes I have to play today that he hasn't returned. I'm wondering if you can get through to his home and maybe ask him to, if you can, to get him down here. That's all.
No, I'm at work, so yeah. I can't. Anyway, I wanted to correct an inaccuracy I heard in that interview.
Sure, go ahead.
In terms of the protection standards in place for low-power FM, I want to distinguish LPFM and micro radio and make a clear distinction that LPFM, low-power FM, is the legal licensed divisive tactic that the FCC put upon the micro radio movement, and the micro radio broadcasters are people like us without licenses. So there's a clear distinction there, and the terms kind of got mixed in that interview, and so I want to make that clear that the LPFM, low-power FM, is legal licensed under 100 watts. Micro radio is illegal pirate radio.
Vinny, we had our own crisis a few months back. Did you find that there was more support pouring into the station, did the crisis atmosphere increase support for free radio?
A little bit, yeah. You're referring to, I think, in December, Berkeley Liberation Radio was raided and seized, and had their equipment stolen by the FCC.
Mm-hmm.
And then we put out a call to action by our listeners to be alert. And yeah, I definitely think so. A couple days after that, we had a power outage, and the phone rang, you know, like 6 or 8 times repeatedly. What happened? You know, you guys getting busted? That kind of stuff. So definitely, yeah, I do think that. And in fact, there is an active investigation happening right now against Free Radio Santa Cruz. Sources, our Free Radio Intelligence Service,
FIA,
for short.
Free Radio.
the Free Radio Intelligence Agency did a little investigation and found out that the Federal Communications Commission was poking around our website just this week on July 7th, and they were looking at various things like our schedule, for example. So there is an active investigation happening. They contacted the owner of the house we broadcast in just 1 month ago, and so yeah. People need to be aware that that is a possibility, that we're going to get a visit soon as well. The other inaccuracy, though, I wanted to correct, in fact, was about the third adjacent protection. She said that you only need to have 2 spaces on the dial. That's an inaccuracy. In fact, you need to have 3 open spaces on the dial. So they're at 93.7. If that was licensed, they would need 93.9, 94.1, and 94.3 would all need to be empty. 94.5 would be able to put up a station. And on the other side, it would be 93, whatever, down 3 channels.
Right, and is that actually happened in any urban areas in this country?
No. No. In fact, even the most rural areas are pretty much the only ones, the only places that LPFM, the legal thing that the FCC did, that have stations. And it's been a very divisive tactic, in fact, and it's been somewhat successful because there were people that were, you know, pretty nationally known advocates for pirate radio who jumped on the bandwagon and, you know, pursued this license thing and encouraged people to, quote, hold their nose and apply, you know. And then they, you know, then, like, now, where are they? They're, like, helping other stations get licensed and stuff, but in the meantime, the war goes on. The micro-radio activists are still out there and still being attacked, and we're still fighting for free speech. You know, the LPFM thing it's deficient. It's not at all, it's not good enough. So we continue to broadcast illegally.
And we'll continue to broadcast, mm-hmm. Meaty.
Yes. And while I'm here on the air, I want to plug a show that's coming up this Friday.
Uh-huh.
A special simulcast. I'm going to be interviewed on KAOS in Olympia, Washington, which is a licensed community station. And we're going to do a simulcast on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and that's happening from 1 to 2 on Friday, this coming Friday. It's going to be live on the radio here and live on the radio in Olympia. And it's going to be a debate. I'm going to be debating the KAOS station manager who is taking up the position of anti-micro radio. And so we're going to be debating micro radio. So it should be interesting. Simulcast. Check it out Friday from 1 to 2.
And rebroadcast, hopefully, as well.
Live. It's going to be live.
Right, but also rebroadcast for those who miss it, right?
Right. Yeah, probably, for sure.
So it's 1 to 2 on Friday, 96.3?
Yep. And, in fact, if people wanted to call in during that show and get on the air, you'd have to call KAOS. So there'll be a number put out as the broadcast is happening. So if people wanted to chime in and have calls, they're going to take calls. So, anyway.
Thank you, V-Man.
Thanks.
All righty. Bye-bye. Here's a resolution that San Francisco Liberation Radio has put forward for the Supes up in San Francisco. Whereas freedom of the press and public access to diverse media are prerequisites for a functioning democracy, and whereas the broadcast airwaves are owned commonly by the public and should be managed to serve the public interest, and whereas adherence to the highest journalistic principles is a public trust, and whereas the public interest is best served by the availability of a broadly diverse range of viewpoints, and whereas media diversity is seriously threatened by further consolidation of media ownership in an already highly concentrated market, and whereas deregulation of radio ownership rules under the 1996 Telecommunications Act caused unprecedented consolidation, dramatically decreasing competition, and whereas radio industry consolidation has also damaged local accountability and content diversity, in part by shifting control and resources away from local programmers and towards central managers, which has led to reductions in local news and public affairs programming and reduced access to the airwaves for local musicians, community groups, and public officials, and whereas the FCC is currently considering an unprecedented rollback of media ownership regulations, which protect competition, content diversity, and local accountability in our media, and whereas the elimination or weakening of these regulations would worsen the effects of radio industry consolidation to date, as ownership deregulation will reduce competition, local accountability, diversity of content and voices, and the amount and quality of news coverage and broadcast and print media across the country, while providing windfall profits for a small handful of corporate media owners, now, therefore, be it resolved by the Board of Supervisors of the City of San Francisco that we recognize that as citizens in a democracy, we require public access to a diverse range of media voices and messages in order to participate fully in our community's shared social, cultural, and political life. We urge the Federal Communications Commission to resist attempts to repeal the cross-ownership ban and further urge the Congress and the Federal Communications Commission to protect content diversity and press freedom by retaining and strengthening existing media ownership regulations, including regulations that limit the number of stations one owner may hold. We further call upon Congress to exercise its oversight in the area of federal communications policy through public hearings on media ownership issues and to pursue legislation aimed at protecting our democratic media by prohibiting further media consolidation. And then here we have it, last but not least, we support local non-commercial LPFM radio in our community, recognizing the important role it plays in providing the people of San Francisco with media diversity. We ask the SFPD and the County of San Francisco Sheriff's Department to refrain from participation in any measures the FCC may take to close down San Francisco Liberation Radio or Bayview Hunters Point Radio. which sounds like it's a step further than the resolution that we at Free Radio Santa Cruz got passed the Santa Cruz City Council. It was in 1997 or thereabouts, supporting Free Radio, with the exception, of course, of Cynthia Matthews, who doesn't like doing anything illegal, you see. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Robert Norse, and this is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Coming up next and shortly is an interview with Keith McHenry, a Food Not Bombs activist currently lodging in Tucson, Arizona. And I'm actually going to read from him, if I can find it on here, a recent press release of his. He has a trial set for a Fourth Avenue arrest. It's going to be on September 19th in Tucson City Court, according to Keith's email. And what he states is, Food Not Bombs co-founder Keith McHenry will be on trial for his arrest while staffing a peace table during the Fourth Avenue street fair on March 22nd, 2003. Everyone is welcome. And he should be calling in shortly. And when he does, we'll put him on. And I don't mean we're going to fool him. I mean we're going to fool around with him. And while we're waiting, let's catch a little music from Phil Oakes from 40 years ago.
In the state of Mississippi, many years ago, a boy of 14 years got a taste of Southern law. He saw his friend a-hanging, his color was his crime, and the blood upon his jacket put a brand upon his mind. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said, too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. His name was Medgar Evers, and he walked his road alone, like Emmett Till and thousands more whose names we'll never know. They tried to burn his home, and they beat him to the ground, but deep inside they both knew what it took to bring him down. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said, too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. The killer waited by his home, hidden by the night, as Evers stepped out from his car into the rifle sight. He slowly squeezed the trigger, the bullet left his side. It struck the heart of every man when Evers fell and died. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said, too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. And they laid him in his grave while the bugle sounded clear, laid him in his grave when the victory was near. While we waited for the future, for freedom through the land, the country gained a killer and the country lost a man. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said, too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. Oh, let it never be again.
And that was Phil Oakes. All the news that's fit to sing from one of his early discs, I guess now on CD, if you're sniffing around to find it. Really good stuff. Just don't wait for Anna Brooks to sing it at City Council. That's all I can say. Well, we should be having a call. In fact, there it is, coming in to us now.
Myself.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello, this is Keith McHenry.
Oh, no, Keith McHenry. I thought we got rid of you, McHenry.
Well, almost.
So you've been gone for what? The police went after you big time in San Francisco and made it pretty hot for you there.
Yeah, I was arrested the last time in San Francisco at a beggar's banquet when Bill Clinton was speaking at a mayor's conference on the privatization of municipal services. And spent like 7-8 days in jail and got charged with another violent felony after I'd already gotten over a 3 strikes case. So I decided to move from there, and I went to work with the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee in Lawrence, Kansas. And that was a pretty interesting experience. And then they didn't pardon Leonard and pardoned a bunch of corporate criminals instead. And then they decided to spend more time like on spiritual matters with Leonard rather than working on his political freedom. So then I moved to Tucson, and that's where I live now.
And you have been getting back into the Food Not Bombs scene?
Yeah, well, we do Tucson Food Not Bombs, and that goes pretty rocky. It's sort of the same thing as other cities where we're harassed by the police every Saturday. And there's a law here, you can't serve free food in city parks. And that law came about even before, well, I mean, in the early days of Tucson Food Not Bombs. And so we like are always experimenting with new locations to serve. And we think came up with a good one where so far the police haven't talked to us in 2 weeks.
Wow. How many times a week do you serve?
In Tucson, only once a week. We serve at 5 o'clock on Congress Street downtown Tucson on Saturdays.
And how long have you been reconnected with Food Not Bombs?
Well, I actually always stayed kind of connected all along. So I have been maintaining the Food Not Bombs website, one of them, foodnotbombs.net. And I've been I'm a co-author of a book on Food Not Bombs. And so I've been helping start chapters and kind of doing that kind of work mostly rather than being on the street so much during the last, since 1995 from the Beggar's Banquet. And I've really only been active with a local chapter about 2 years now in Tucson.
How long has the Food Not Bombs been in Tucson?
And it was here in the, I would say probably about 93 or something of that nature, 94.
How big is Tucson?
It's 700,000 people.
Huh.
So it's very big, and it's one of the fastest growing cities in the United States.
A lot of homeless people there?
And a lot of homeless people, particularly in the winter. The homeless, although this summer is very unusual. This is like an unusual summer in that there are a lot more homeless people than normal here because of, you know, it's 100 and, well, it'll be like 108 today. And, you know, it's very dangerous, and it's not super homeless-friendly city. There's a few shelters, you know, Salvation Army type things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one actually progressive group called Primavera who has a huge number of homeless services, and you know, some are slightly questionable, like they have one for where you work, and it's kind of you know, you get a job with them, but it's you know, it is minimum wage, and a lot of times the jobs are skilled, so it's kind of too bad, you know, they don't, but it's, and they advertise actually to the business community that they have cheap labor available, and that's how they get the business community to hire them. So on one level, but the wages here are very bad, even no matter what, you know, this is incredibly terrible wages. So I guess in some senses it's not so bad, but they should pay people like $10 an hour, but they get away with minimum wage.
Well, you know, when you were in San Francisco, many regarded San Francisco as kind of the quintessence of liberalism. You know, of course, the Rush Limbaugh and the Michael Savages are always denouncing San Francisco. And indeed, in San Francisco at the present time, you have a board of supervisors which, you know, is turned against the Gavin Newsom, what do I call it, cash
really
for
cool.
Callousness. They call it compassion, not or not cash or whatever it is. But San Francisco has a reputation, you know, of being very liberal, and you actually came to San Francisco from another liberal community, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and you found a rather nasty reception, right?
Correct, yeah. I was, once I was involved in the San Francisco scene, I realized that the people of San Francisco are by and large very liberal. But the government, and particularly both the state government, but also the city government, was in no way progressive. And it kind of shocked me, because I assumed it, you know, in Cambridge, we were loved by the by City Hall, and Al Vellucci, who was the mayor, was like a good friend of mine, and he had given away free food on the streets during the Great Depression against when it was, and it was against the law at the time, you know, so he was very supportive, and Cambridge is a very progressive, or was a progressive government. And so I assumed this, you know, San Francisco, with all of its fame for being so progressive, would be the same. But it turns out that it was not so, and the city government was super, super repressive.
You were arrested, what, over 100 times there?
Yeah, about 105 times.
And you were beaten, what?
13 times.
13. How many times did you go to the hospital?
And, well, I went to the hospital, like, maybe four or five of those beatings at the direction of the police. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the hospital a few times on my own after being released. And I got two surgeries to reconstruct my sinuses from the baton to the face. I was hit between the eyes, and it broke my my sinus cavities, and so I had to have two reconstructive surgeries for that. And you know, the and then I still like have like lots of problems as a direct result of the police beatings. So kind of is ongoing.
Wow. What kind of legal recompense did you get? I know you sought to sue for civil damages. Instead, the city went after Food Not Bombs with an injunction, which is still enforced, although it's, I guess, ignored by the city, right?
Right, right. It's a permanent injunction. I personally have a couple of permanent injunctions. I'm not allowed to protest within 150 yards of any government official, government building, or anything like that in San Francisco, and I still have that outstanding. And so, and that kind of makes going to any demonstrations technically in San Francisco a situation where I can be arrested just for attending. And then there's a permanent injunction against anyone from serving free food and transporting free food for the purposes of giving it away for free, or even preparing free food, although no one has really been arrested for preparing it. The transporting and serving have been the principal things that they bust us for there. And that injunction, we also, though, had 15, we fought back in the courts, and we had 15 federal lawsuits and 15 state lawsuits against the city, and then we did some small claims stuff against the city as well. And we actually didn't win any of those. The only case that I actually ever won in San Francisco, besides avoiding doing life in prison, which is, of course, a pretty good victory, is I sued the U.S. Park Police for breaking my dog's leg on the last day of the Persian Gulf War and got my vet bill paid. But otherwise, that's been like the courts seem pretty corrupt in the Bay Area, in my experience. And things like, for instance, I was beaten on October 15th of 1988 at a protest against the war in El Salvador, and the guy who did the crime for which I was arrested, which turned out to be an undercover cop, and we had video of him throwing police barricade at a group of riot police, and he was dressed just like me, and it looked similar to me. And I came to learn that there was actually Keith McHenry doubles in the police department. They would do crimes in my near proximity, and then I would be arrested for them. And I guess that's kind of traditional standard police, community organizing disruption tactics. And then and with that, though, there was also a wiretap memo on that case. And you could see the wiretap memo online at foodnotbombs.net /spy.html. And there's like a little brief bunch of documents and stuff like that that talk about the surveillance of San Francisco Food Not Bombs and of other left groups in the Bay Area, and also of our ultimate effort to reverse that situation, where we went to the UN and to Amnesty International, and we were able to win support from both those organizations against the brutality of the San Francisco police. And so in that situation, you know, like we provided evidence of my phone being wiretapped, the police claiming they were plotting to take over an army base on the day of the beating, in which the beating happened, and completely fabricating this whole weird story, which made us out to be like international terrorists or something. And this is way before the terrorist thing was so popular as it is now. But the judge just like ruled that the wiretap memo, even though it directly talked about the incident, was inadmissible in court. The sections of the video that showed the undercover cop doing the crime was ruled inadmissible in court.
What judge was this, Keith?
I can't remember. It's two different judges, and I don't remember the names. Jensen, I think, was one of them.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, you think, wow, you know, here's an airtight case where you've got a videotape that's seamless. It wasn't even edited. They just kept the video running from the point of view of the cop throwing the barricades to protesters confronting the undercover cop to a situation where they then, you know, show me getting thrown to the ground and with what's called a cross-chest takedown, according to the police expert, but with this kind of maniacal way of, which you probably see in Santa Cruz, I think it's standard police procedures, where to terrorize political activists, so what they'll do is they'll get like three or like six cops, they'll get one or two on each limb, and they whip you around violently on the ground, pulling your arms and legs in as opposite of directions as possible to cause maximum pain and damage to your tendons and ligaments, which of course can't be x-rayed as damaged and can't be photographed as bruised, but cause really incredible pain for up to a month afterwards. And this is something they train in the police schools on what to do to political activists in the United States. And in fact, I'm working on, I'm a co-founder with an organization that's just now starting up on about political torture in the United States of political activists, and is little known about the fact that that's a common tactic, that what happens to political activists here is not all that different than what happens to political activists around the world. And in fact, those people in other countries are usually the victims of U.S. foreign policy and of training by people here in the United States, by law enforcement. And Tucson has a couple of interesting things. One of them is we do have the undergraduate school of torture, or called here information extraction, at Fort Huachuca. And the people that were involved in my case and cases in San Francisco of beatings were trained by students who had graduated from here and gone to Fort Ord back when that was, that had the postgraduate school of information extraction, and then we're carrying out those policies against activists in the, all over the United States and all over the world. So, you know, and we see now in the big stories about, oh, the U.S. can't be torturing the people in Guantanamo Bay, they have to ship them abroad because we don't torture people. Well, that's a lot of nonsense.
Where can people who are interested get information about this online? Are there any documents you would recommend?
Yeah, well, if you go to the Food Not Bombs website at foodnotbombs.net, and then go to...
Is it Food Not Bombs or FNB?
No, Food Not Bombs.
Okay.
All one word, .net. And then there's a... you can, and then you, for the stuff about spying, you can go to... then you just put /spy... .html, and it'll take you to a page about surveillance, and it has like extensive articles written on the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, B'nai B'rith spy scandal. You've got like links to information on the New Patriot Act 2, and you know, there's some concern in the future that left organizations in the United States can, and particularly ones that are classified as terrorists, like Food Not Bombs is, you may recall a funny story, a number of stories, actually, 14 to be exact, 14 accounts of people who were wearing a Food Not Bombs button and were confronted by military personnel who would have conversations with them and say, oh, we studied your Food Not Bombs and counterterrorism school. Food Not Bombs is one of the most hardcore terrorist groups in the United States. And that first occurred with a woman named Sonia who went to visit her friend in Santa Rosa, California, and then her friend's husband came back from 3 days of training at the Presidio when that was an active military base. And he said, oh, wow, you know, they only cook food as a front. They're one of America's most hardcore terrorist groups. And that was 1989 or 90. So that's before the whole, you know, witch hunt mentality that we're facing now since 9/11. And, you know, so they've been having this idea of declaring people terrorists for quite some time, and it does not really get much to do. You know, 9/11 was just a great excuse to step up for this kind of activity. And
well, what kind of terrorist activities have you been up to in Tucson?
Well, the terrorist type things that we enjoy doing are, we did a weapons inspection at Raytheon Missile Systems here, and where 8 of us were arrested, and we got 50 of us to dress in lab coats and these hard hats that were donated by a local thrift store, and went to go on to the site to check for weapons of mass destruction like 2 days before Blix finished his, or was going to give his report in New York City about weapons in Iraq. And that is definitely a terrorist act. And I did a literature table at a Hate Street Fair, I keep saying a Hate Street Fair because that's what I'm used to going to, at the 4th Avenue Street Fair, which is the little, that's the equivalent of the Telegraph Ave of Tucson. And I was doing a literature table on the Saturday after the war started, and on March 22nd, I think is what that day was, and I was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct for complaining to, in a very soft and gentle manner, to this merchant association dude. We call them the Yellow Jackets, which I guess are like the...
The hosts have the in same, Santa Cruz.
Huh?
Probably like the purple-shirted hosts.
Yeah, like what you have. We have the Yellow Jackets and the... And the purple shirts too. We have like two of these merchants association guys, and they move any. If you sit on, I was like leaning on a ledge of the co-op, which is on that street 4th Ave, and got like told that I had to stand up. I wasn't allowed to lean against the building, you know. And then they'd photograph you, and you can get a $250 fine if you sit down anywhere within the business district. You know, they got this all over the country now, I guess all over the world. But at the fair, I was like a few booths down from a guy who was playing Rush Limbaugh as loud as possible, and into the crowd. And so I was like yelling out to the people walking by and going, "Come sign the petition to impeach Bush. You know, people are dying as we speak in Iraq. Bombs are falling and killing civilians." And Merchants Association did not want us talking about peace, and harassed us for like 3 hours and took photographs of us like for 3 hours. Brought the police over, but since we weren't breaking any laws, they couldn't get rid of us. So eventually the merchant association guy that had been staked out at my table, and the cops came, and they would like lean their bikes across the front of our banners and stand in front of the table, and so people couldn't get to it, and disrupted the whole activity for most of the day. And then towards the end of the day, the merchant association official had me arrested for insulting him. And
in fact, with your terrorist ways, insult him?
Well, I told him he should be ashamed of himself for harassing me for the whole afternoon and trying to impede, you know, our ability to get out information about peace. And so I was very polite about it, and told him to his face. Very,
that can be the worst kind of insult, Keith. This kind of clever niceness you use can be very insidious.
Well,
could be an
you
aggravating
much.
Situation.
Well, that was it. And I spent just 28 hours in jail, fortunately. And now I go to court on September 19th for this case. And
Are you represented by any the ACLU or the National Lawyers Guild or the Mountain Legal Association jumped in?
We do. I have a person from the ACLU named Chris who's my attorney in this case. I also have another very humorous case pending where on the day the war started in Iraq and or whatever it is called that is happening in Iraq, we were doing a Food Not Bombs table at the federal building, and there was a pretty large protest there. And towards the end of the protest, 7 Marines came in, like, Marine Corps T-shirts and stuff, and a bullhorn, and screaming at us to go home and go watch CNN, the rally's over. And so the guy with the bullhorn stood right behind me, and he was teetering on the edge of the fountain above my head, so I got up and to step away, and he backed up and fell into the fountain, which was a very deep fountain, actually. It went up to his waist, and his bullhorn was submerged. So I was, even though the other Marines were shoving protesters in the chest and pushing them around, and one of the protesters who was hit pretty hard went to the police and asked that he be stopped and that he be arrested for assault. Instead, the only person arrested for was me, and that was for assault and destruction of property. So,
well, aren't you the head of this terrorist conspiracy in Tucson? Aren't you, in fact, the key man behind the cauliflower front?
Yeah, I should be, but I've been working really actively with Pledge of Resistance, which we have a very good chapter of here in Tucson, and we're currently focusing on protests against depleted uranium, because the other thing that happens in Tucson is that this is the training base for A-10-11s, which is the warthogs, is the kind of the fun name that they use for these jets. And they pass over all day long in Tucson. And they are very slow-moving, low-flying jets that are used to launch depleted uranium rounds and anti-personnel rounds at civilian populations, and were used extensively in Baghdad and then other cities in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. So we do a lot of organizing against the use of depleted uranium. And, you know, one thing to point out is, you know, every day it seems like one or two U.S. GIs are killed in Iraq. But the huge amounts of depleted uranium were used against Iraq in both the First War and the Second War. And thousands of people already, 10,000 vets have died from the Gulf War, from Gulf War syndrome, which might have something to do with the use of depleted uranium. And we expect that the body count is going to be very high in the current occupation because, you know, in the first Gulf War, the depleted uranium was where the U.S. troops were, was out in the desert, not in urban areas. And they also were only there for a short while. Now there's over 100,000 U.S. troops standing around in Baghdad and these cities in an environment where there's huge amounts of radioactive material that are blowing, particularly when those big sandstorms and stuff were happening in the early portions of the invasion. And the casual out of this 100,000 or 150,000 U.S. troops that are there, you know, easily be 10,000 or more of those soldiers are going to die in the next 10 years, probably, from the effects of the depleted uranium used against the Iraqis. And, of course, the death toll of Iraqis from this use of depleted uranium is going to be incredible, and there's already been maybe as much as 5,000 people a month have been dying from the Gulf War I. So, you know, we're trying to point out that the casualties aren't only just from people shooting each other and actual bombs hitting them and killing them, but it's also this other weapons of mass destruction that were used by the United States against the people of Iraq. So, sure, there's weapons of mass destruction. It just turned out that it was they were looking for them at the wrong, you know, from the wrong people. So, And those weapons of mass destruction, and many of them are made right here in Tucson. I think you guys make weapons of mass destruction, don't you, up in north of
Santa Cruz? There's been claimed that, yeah, that the Lockheed facility has been involved with that. I think we tried to get information back in the early 80s, and I think they claimed that had been shut down or something, but they turned away our inspectors, too. I didn't have my white coat with me, but I was taking photos of some of the white coats that went up there to, you know, make the Lockheed follow in line with UN resolutions and, you know, to assist Hans Blix and, of course, President Bush's policy of eliminating the weapons of mass destruction. For some reason, unfathomably, they were not allowed to enter the base and do the investigating that they needed to do.
Yeah, see, that was the thing that got me, is of course they can't find them in Iraq. They're looking in the wrong country.
Well, you know, there are bureaucratic tie-ups in this whole business, as we saw with the CIA and the business of the Nigerian uranium and all that, Niger's uranium.
Yeah, right. It's, you know, the uranium is easy to find. I mean, the U.S. has been selling it. They're mining it. They're buying it. They're deploying it. You know, another thing I like to, you know, you get, like, I got an email once from some person who was very supportive of George Bush and slaughter of the Iraqis, and he was and what did I ever do to, you know, stop the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? And actually I did, you know, so I reported to him that Food Not Bombs had gone to the Howard Johnson's 57 in Boston, Massachusetts, to protest the weapons bazaar, and we were all arrested instantly and on exiting our vehicle. And the Rumsfeld and his the different companies that were now going to so-called rebuild Iraq and have play roles in that, they were selling, and particularly DuPont Corporation was like a major one, were selling chemical and biological weapons to Iraq, and that they were one of the largest participants of attendees at this weapons bazaar. And that was in 1982. So
old history, ancient history, son. We had allies, now they're our enemies. I mean, and now they're actually they're allies again.
Right.
So, you know, things change fast.
They do change fast. It's funny. And whoever the new puppet government that the United States installs, and, you know, we could see that both in Afghanistan, that poor guy, he must be reading books on Noriega and stuff, right? And
What's the Tucson population thinking about the latest brouhaha around the, you know, the lies that are coming out of the Bush administration are becoming increasingly more publicized, that, you know, the no connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, lies about uranium in Bush's speech, failure to find the weapons of mass destruction, and most of all, the rising U.S. casualties. Any sense of whether the conservative Tucsoners are getting a little fed up with this?
Well, it's a funny thing. I think they're getting sheepish about it. You know, get the right, because there is like a, well, we do have a really wonderful and really large activist community in Tucson. And, of course, everybody in that community has been talking about these lies since way before the war and then before this, even the theft of the election, different intelligence gaffes and lies. But the average Joes that were so excited about the beauty of the war and the victory of the war and everything like that, that I meet at like the YMCA and stuff like that, are now embarrassed. Do seem embarrassed, and that their comments are, oh, they'll find these weapons of mass destruction, and oh, they'll, and there is a very hardcore crew here in Tucson who are very dedicated to Clear Channel, which is the majority of the radio stations in our city are owned by Clear Channel. And the other thing is that the Fox TV here is very, very popular amongst this group, and they're like promoting the glory and the beauty of the war. And so while all these, it's like now these are kind of, the conservative community seems to be at least, you know, not all rah, rah, rah like they were. And I think they're starting to, in some senses, because they're not so enthusiastic as they were and so quick to harass me and other people like me, it shows signs that they are a little worried that it's so fast from when we were saying that what's going on is going on to it now being revealed that it's going on. you know, it's caught them a little off balance because they were just so, like, in your face about how great this is.
We're talking with Keith McHenry, a Food Not Bombs activist from Tucson, Arizona. Keith, San Francisco prosecution has essentially dropped most, if not all, the charges against the anti-war protesters, mainly because a lot of them were bogus charges, but also because for other reasons. Do you anticipate your case of, I guess, what, politically tabling for the wrong political persuasion? No, disorderly conduct is the actual charge you're charging.
All right. Yeah, free speech in public.
Is that going to be dropped? What's your prediction?
No, actually, down here in Tucson, they don't seem to be dropping these things. It's a number of activists arrested during the current situation is, have been already prosecuted and convicted, and for really minor things. But you know, like one of my friends, Rachel Wilson, who's like a, you know, really like super active on campus here at University of Arizona, she ended up having to plead guilty, forced into like a really bad situation where she was facing really heavy charges and then accepted like lesser, you know, guilt and lesser charges. And she had to go to anger management school and stuff like this for attending the pool. She basically stepped off the curb at a... You remember, like, Michael Brown, the city manager of
Berkeley?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Michael Brown was a city manager here in Tucson as well.
Used to be in Berkeley, the cry was, Brown, out of town. I remember that.
Right. Well, Brown, when he was in Tucson, set up the SWAT team and here, and the whole political surveillance type of trip. And then the city government, you know, this is a Republican state, even though we now sort of have supposedly a Democrat in as governor, but the state and its entire, you know, like our city council is Republican and so on. They really seem to be interested in trying to shut down any protests. And we had several anti-globalization protests here, which were shot at with rubber bullets and people really badly beaten. And, you know, the violence by the police against demonstrators is, you know, similar to that you find in San Francisco. And so, no, I don't think that the charges will probably be dropped. You know, they will go forward and with these cases, and it's kind of lame, and I expect there'll be more cases. I've had some funny experiences with surveillance recently too. It's I've been volunteering to do this like native plant restoration at the Nature Conservancy building here in Tucson, and there was an undercover cop staking that out.